The problem was, is instead of explaining the why to the employees and how it can work and will work to benefit them on their day-to-day, they were just throwing tools at it. So, hey, go do this tool, go do that tool. And there was no good backbone behind why you would use the tool and where it's going to benefit you and how you move it forward.
Welcome to Why They Fail, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on why continuous improvement efforts fail. Buckle up, because we're not here for motivational fluff. We're dissecting the short-sighted decisions and leadership agendas that sabotage CI success. But don't worry, we'll clue you in to the few simple keys to success to avoid these pitfalls. If you're ready for the truth, let's do this.
Welcome to another episode of Why They Fail, the podcast dedicated to uncovering the uncomfortable truths about operational excellence and systemic change. Today, we are diving deep into how fragmented strategies and chaotic project execution can blind an organization, leaving teams disconnected from the bigger picture. Joining us is Melissa Sherman, an independent consultant and board member with over 27 years of deep operational expertise in the utility industry. Her career spans complex investor-owned utilities and electric cooperatives with specialized focuses on electric and gas distribution engineering, large-scale enterprise change initiatives, and value stream transformations. As a proven lean practitioner and change management leader, Melissa excels at evaluating existing business processes, leveraging data for root cause analysis, and designing sustainable, repeatable improvements that deliver measurable results aligned with strategic objectives. Beyond her field deployment work, Melissa has served as a higher education instructor since 2008, teaching online and in-seat courses in management, entrepreneurship, and industrial engineering. She also serves as vice chair on the board of directors for the Michigan Lean Consortium and frequently speaks at major industry platforms, including the ISO 9000 and Audits World Conference. Melissa thrives on breaking down complex methodologies into practical, relatable terms, creating those powerful, eye-opening moments that empower teams to tackle significant obstacles with confidence. Let us jump right into our conversation with Melissa.
Melissa, what was your catalyst that got you into continuous improvement? How did you get started in this? Tell us your story.
Yeah, so I'll say way back in the day, it wasn't really in the forefront of my brain. I went to college for industrial engineering because I didn't know what type of engineering I wanted to do. And industrial hits on a lot of them, right? You hit a little chemical, you hit a little mechanical, electrical, and all that. And then after I got done with that, I had the aha moment of how much that relates to that continuous improvement. And so it became embedded in what I did throughout my career from a personal aspect. But then it really skyrocketed and went forward probably about 6-7 years ago when I was part of a lean organization at a utility and how to build continuous improvement within the organization so that they could be more sustainable, and not just in utility rates, but how the crews worked, how we did different things in the utility. And so, yeah, that's really what jolted me forward. And now I'm out on a freelance doing that, which I really enjoy helping a variety of businesses.
And what utility were you employed with?
It's an investor-owned utility in Michigan. Consumers Energy, one of the two largest utilities in Michigan. The other investor-owned is DTE.
A lot of people wouldn't really equate utilities to something like Lean or Six Sigma, but it applies very well.
It does. You just have to be in the right mindset because they don't make widgets per se, but it's really how you plan your day, what you do, whether you're in a generating facility or out on the road installing electric and gas lines. And everything in between, really.
You mentioned that utility leaders frequently hire from automotive plants, and they try to force this kind of a strict widget mentality into a service industry. How does that create that toy scenario where they play with lean tools until really the novelty wears off?
Yeah, I'll just say, again, experience. And then when you go on and you change industries, right, you can look back and say, oh, I think I could have done X, Y, and Z differently. I think one of the hangups in the utility wasn't the fact that they brought in individuals that worked in automotive. Because, right, we just mentioned you can have and should have lean no matter what industry you're in, from a law office to service to a manufacturing. The problem was instead of explaining the why to the employees and how it can work and will work to benefit them on their day-to-day, they were just throwing tools at it. So, hey, go do this tool, go do that tool. And there was no good backbone behind why you would use the tool and where it's going to benefit you and how you move it forward. So it wasn't building a philosophy first, it was tool-based.
Give me an example of, in the past, somebody just throwing a tool and how that was detrimental.
Yeah, so if I go back prior to the lean journey there, we rolled out, which is not uncommon, RCAs or root cause analysis, and really digging into the 5-why portion of it. But there was a good backbone and a good understanding. Well, then lean comes along, or continuous improvement, however you want to coin it. And it's like, hey, here's the 8D or 8 steps of problem solving. But we didn't take time to really say, hey, here's how you define your problem. Here's how you break it down. And so they're still trying to solve the whole pie, right? Instead of a piece of a pie, because they're given a tool and not totally understanding an application to be extremely successful. In my short term, just quickly, short term of them implementing. So they're young in their journey. They started in about 2016. And so 10 years, they've probably gone through 5 to 6 different iterations and how they've tried to roll it out. Right. So when you have that, it feels like it's the new flavor of the week, and it makes it harder for people to want to get on the bus and ride, right, and follow that journey to be really improvement and sustainable.
In my book, I focus really heavily on the simple key of using non-fuzzy metrics. So why do you think executives are so prone to focusing on downstream systems like scheduling instead of using objective data to attack those constraints?
Would it rely on just executives? I would say it's a variety of levels within the company. And again, it's going to come back to culture. If you don't have a culture of continuous improvement, right? I think of the House of Lean and the base of stability. And that can mean a lot of things to a lot of people, but to me, stability is building the culture. And so if you don't have that, metrics are chosen where it's easy to measure and you can always see green instead of trying to raise the bar and saying red is good. And so that's where I think one of the downfalls has been, at least in a utility, is that they're afraid of red. And so therefore, they're going to go where they know they can make a quick fix to have it green. Versus, again, going upstream to say, oh, hey, design or customer service isn't giving us the right information so that we can build this properly. So our schedulers are going to jump through hoops to get this to a customer by said date. And therefore, because they have the metric of on-time delivery, they're going to do whatever they can to meet that metric. And it's not just executive level, as I mentioned, but there's, when you look at a utility, you're regulated by a public service commission. So some of the metrics are based on what they say also.
The metrics, you were talking about looking at metrics that only give you the good and not the bad, the red. So I see that in a lot of places where they call us in to help them improve, but the leadership says, we're good. All of our metrics says we're good. But when you look down on the floor, you see something different, right? You talk about the structure, talk about the infrastructure. And it's funny to me, a lot of people call us up. They ask us, we want a couple of people trained as green belts or lean agents. And I always ask, well, what kind of a structure do you have for them to survive in? And I usually get the equivalent of the blank stare over the phone. They're like, I don't know what that means. I just want to have somebody come in and be our lone CI guy, and I want them to go out and solve problems. And I say that they're going to learn great things, but that's not going to happen. Mm-mm. So without a good structure, you're not going to have sustainable change. You're going to send people out on arbitrary missions to solve problems of pains that you see presently, right? But without data and without structure and without visibility, you're not going to know where to solve a problem. So I find that a lot of companies, they really are blind, not blind, but they mean to be blind to the bad things that are going on, and they only show the good things. You spent a lot of time focusing on psychological safety recently. Does a lack of safety in an organization's culture feed the CI myth that Bell is just a lone problem solver whose job is to really to step in and fix things, then facilitate our own change?
I think so, yes, right? So again, going back to the house of lean stability and culture, and in order to get that culture, you have to have the psychological safety where people are willing to challenge the status quo or willing to just to learn. I'm not going to go to this internal, I'll call it green belt, because I have to check a box and, oh, our metric is to have 100% of our employees go through this class by the end of the year, right? And if you're not doing due diligence in the class. So I think psychological safety is a huge thing in any company, but specifically where I was at, because there was a lack of trust is maybe the best way, or confidence in, again, applying lean to a utility, because there have been occasions where a continuous improvement was driven by a budget cut. So you're wanting to cut to maintain a budget, but yet you're not sustainable because you cut it, right? What can I do, right, to be sustainable so that whatever improvement I make is going to be there in 6 months or a year or 5 years down the road, or it's iteratively improved even more?
Let's go back to the utility. Tell me about a time that you had a loss of success and maybe sometimes that you didn't. When you first went into the utility and started to implement continuous improvement, how much pushback did you get? How did they adopt this?
Yeah, I'm going to say adoption was ebb and flow depending on the individual. So there were about, we'll say 7 to 12 of us at any given time in our lean office working with different organizational hierarchy groups. And so depending on, one, your ability as the CI consultant, as we were called, or your knowledge, depended how well it was adopted. I'll knock on wood. I'll say I'm fortunate in the fact that I've taught higher education for almost 20 years. And so I understand an adult learner, and I will apply and teach differently than maybe some of my counterparts did. And so I worked with a group which was called EPM, or Enterprise Project Management, which touched on everything in the company because they were managing projects. I was fortunate with my adoption rate. So one of the things that I had, back to your first question about a success, was we were implementing value stream mapping, not total end-to-end as you would do a typical value stream. And there were select groups that were hand-chosen because of the work they were doing. And unfortunately, you walk in because they were voluntold, we'll call it that. And so there was the negativity, I guess you could say, of why am I here? What am I doing? How is this benefiting me? And by the time we got done with it over the course of probably 6 to 8 months, there was the aha. And then really a year later, once we could take the one Kaizen that we focused on and monitor because of the construction season of April to October, once we could monitor at the end of the following October, from our improvements, they seen a gain of almost $3 million.
Wow.
So once they seen that, and then they realized, even though we couldn't celebrate it because they were worried it was pulled out of their budget, right? But once they seen that and they could figure out how they could do other things to be more efficient and get more budget money to do other things that need to be done, there was again that aha revelation that, oh, I can see how this works. But I was there to coach and assist them along the way. It wasn't, oh, here it is, now go do, right? It's really working with the individuals so that they get comfortable with, whether it's the problem solving, whether it's the PDCA, specifically the check and the act, you know, great at, okay at planning, great at doing, but not necessarily checking and confirming and acting upon it. So once they were assisted through that, there was that revelation. And even when I left the company here recently, they were still being successful in that process that we had stood up in 2021. So 5 years of being successful.
Wow. It was a tough culture to break into, right? Yes. You said there was a lot of people that were voluntold to go. And I see that in every class that we teach. We've got people that didn't know until like 2 days before the class.
Yeah.
And others had a little bit more time. But there really wasn't a culture or a want to be in there. I was told to be in there. It makes it very hard for us to turn that around in the class, although we do. I just talked to a young lady that works for AstraZeneca and another that works for Amazon, and they have such an embedded and an amazing culture where they don't tell people to go to training. They let people pick that training. They let them find it and experiment with it. You're not told to go do something. You're given the option of, hey, we've got this training. This is how it can benefit you. This is how it benefits the company. It's up to you whether you want to be in it. But if you're in it, there's some benefits to it and, you know, putting an icing on the cake. And then all of a sudden, the people that come into that training, they want to be there and they're hungry to learn. I've talked to people that have been in companies like yours, Melissa, where it didn't really start out with that culture. And especially in a utility company, kind of an embedded culture. People have been there for many years and change is very hard to accept. The other thing that I found out is a lot of times wins, successes breed more successes, right? You go in, even though you have that culture where you got people that are sitting in the class with their arms crossed, looking at you like, who is this person? But then you start to show them where they actually tell you where the changes are going to be made, but it's all done through tools. So they're doing it without even knowing it. And then all of a sudden seeing that change being made and seeing the result of it, all of a sudden they come back into another class with their arms open because they've seen the results. So yes, I think that's what happened.
Yeah, one of the things that I've done in class, right, because you're going to have the person that wants to be there too, like the one, right, their arms are crossed. And then again, the struggle of how do I do this in a utility or service industry in general? You know, it's all manufacturing. I like to bring in a lot of personal or home experiences, right? So example, I'll ask folks have gone, you know, if we're talking about standard work and they're trying to figure out why do I need standard work? You know, where is this benefiting me? I'm like, okay, how many of you guys own a car? Most, if not all, will raise their hand. And then I get what's in the glove box? Of course, usually I get the stares then because they're trying to think, okay, what is she asking here? But right, I'm looking for the manual, right? You've got a manual for your car in there. That's the standard work for the car. If you choose not to follow the manual and not to get the services when it's recommended, the longevity of your car might go down. And the manufacturer doesn't know what they may need to adjust for the next version of that car. And then all of a sudden the light bulb's going, oh, I have this at home. I'm using this, right? Or I'm not, right? And so it's really trying to put some personal analogies towards Sabrina at the time.
When an organization eliminates its change management team in the name of cost cutting, aren't they falling into the plumber mistake by expecting technical specialists to build a cultural house they aren't equipped to lead?
Yes. And I guess every organization is going to have a different, I'll go with value or application of change management. We know change management isn't just communication.
Mm-hmm.
So if your organization feels change management is just communication and it's cut because whether it's cost cutting, whatever it is, and you just use your comms department, it's not really breaking the camel's back. It wasn't beneficial in the first place. So it's not really, doesn't make a difference. But when you're taking what I would call a true change management team, where they're really wanting to know who the stakeholders are, how are they affected? How are we going to communicate to them? Is it just written? Is it video like this? Is it a face-to-face, whatever it is? That's when you're going to have that true sustainment. And if you pull that away, that's where you're going to have some of those bumpy roads when you're trying to implement or continue to have continuous improvement in your organization. Because if you're not thinking about and not training your employees on what a change curve is, and you know, Kevin, he's just going to come in and say, hey, here's a problem I solved and we're going to implement this tomorrow. And then 2 weeks later, wonder why it's not effective. Well, we didn't talk with those that were affected by it to figure out where they were at. I think there's more of a hindrance if you cut a true change management team, or if you don't at least have, if you're going to cut it, at least have a handful, depending on the size of your organization, of individuals who know what change is and understand the benefits of it so that they can apply it within what they do, specifically in continuous improvement, but in everything in general.
I find that companies that cut the change management team or the Six Sigma team, a lean team, or the continuous improvement team have really not acquired the ability to change, right? So they cut the change management team because it doesn't have an effect. But it doesn't have an effect because they haven't really given the right tools to actually make change. So they have them go out and take on arbitrary projects that are based on what the pain is. And when you don't have that structure to pick the right projects and you pick these suboptimal projects, then I've had CFOs come to me and say, well, we did this Kaizen event on step three, but nothing changed. The end product still didn't get out the door. So what was going on? I said, well, that's because you just picked step three. But step three wasn't the constraint in the process. And we told you that. When you take on continuous improvement and you do it haphazardly, like a shotgun blast, hoping that you're hitting the right problem, then that leads to not having success, and not having success gets blamed on the methodology, not on the way that you put in the methodology. I tell my students, unless you have the structure built, things like this are probably going to happen. So I tell them, you're going to learn great tools, but when you leave, because you don't have that structure, you don't have bought-in executives, you don't have a project hopper, you don't have a correlation to your KPIs, you just have leaders that say, hey, I've got a new toy, a new green belt, a new lean practitioner, and I've got all these problems going on the floor, so I'm going to sick them on those problems, right? But there is no scientific way to understand what problem to take on first. And I will tell you that most of the time, the problems that they get assigned to aren't the problem.
I just want to add to that a little bit. A couple of things that I've seen is, one, we pick too many problems to solve at once. And then if we're not thinking about change management, I might be inundating, you know, Joe down the way with six things, but Sue on the other side only has one. Right. And so if we're not looking holistically at a company of what we're problem solving and implementation and effectiveness, could cause a downward spiral.
Yes.
The other thing I would say, and it might have been an advantage to me. So, right, as I mentioned, industrial engineering, and I was in the utility for 35 years, so a long time. And then I spent about 2.5 years in change management within the same utility. And then I went into our lean office while I was there. I've seen a huge benefit as that is all inclusive. I don't see psychological safety as this pillar, and then change management as this pillar, and then continuous improvement, lean, Six Sigma as another pillar. They're really all intertwined. And I think it's beneficial, especially as a practitioner, to have a very good understanding of all of those, because I think it helps your success. It helps you know, it helps you communicate with individuals, with understanding where they're at, building the trust with them. And once you can build the trust with them, right, that psychological safety, then you can start showing them how to use the tools. Then you can say, hey, when we're doing this, who is this improvement affecting? How do they need to change it? And you start intertwining all of it. It's really what's helped me be more successful in having, I'll say, one, repeat customers, whether it was internally or externally, because it's taken the time to get to know you, understanding where the true problem is at, challenging if it is the true problem you want to go after, and then moving forward.
You're saying that really to build continuous improvement, you have to start out building a culture. People want to do it. You can't just hire somebody or set somebody on the path of, I want you to be a lean practitioner, go learn it, and then come back and start making change, right? It has to be something that we start a culture and then we build into a continuous improvement.
Yeah. Just brought to mind something else I did as we talk utilities, but I think it can be beneficial across the way. So originally I mentioned I worked directly with the VP of our enterprise project management group. As they should, every year they set up their KPIs. So you have your top organizational level, right? And they work. So I was working level one through level four. So VP through frontline managers. And they would all pick theirs, but they wouldn't have a, relatively speaking, clue on how what they were picking worked up the hierarchy. So I ended up building out a true KPI tree from our CEO down to show those connections. And once they seen that, they could go, oh, you know what? This isn't the right KPI for us to help the company move forward, but hey, this is the right KPI that we need for our level or our department. And so really building and I'm a visual person. So really building that visual KPI out and how they all interconnected also brought an aha moment to that group, because they could say, oh, I see what I'm doing, how it affects the company, how it affects our overall bottom line, and how it affects us as an internal organization.
The transparency in that is amazing. But most companies don't do that. They have organizational KPIs, and you go out on the floor and you ask, how are you affecting the overall organizational success? And most of the time, I look at you and go, well, I don't know. Go talk to my lead or my supervisor. I work all day long, and I think I've done what I need to do. And then I either get patted on the back or I get yelled at. But I don't know which one's coming. And having that transparency to understand exactly what I do, how it affects the cell, the department, the site, the organization, all cascading down, that's where I find the most companies miss. Because we only manage KPIs from an ivory tower, right? The plant managers, the business unit leaders, the chief nursing officers, they all sit in the room and talk about what they did and what they did wrong. But the people who aren't in that room are the people who actually are the ones doing it. And again, they don't know.
I would even add to that. So recently I was at another company doing an ISO audit for them, because I've transitioned to doing some ISO auditing. And I gave them kudos because they were on it. It's probably one of the first companies I ever went to that said, yep, we go to the Gemba on a daily basis. We have stand-up huddles. They had the continuous improvement down, but there was a slight lack on a KPI perspective, because they want to reduce scrap, as who doesn't? And they do scrap bonuses. So if they're under a threshold, a scrap bonus goes out. Well, as we're looking at records, they happen to show me an individual that he's at like 129% productivity, but his scrap rate was 21%. And I said, so is he getting the same scrap bonus as the other ones that might have been at the 8% or less? And they go, well, yeah. And I'm like, is that fair? The 129%, I don't know this for sure, right? But he probably had no clue. He's like, oh, I keep getting a scrap bonus. So if I can keep my productivity up, who cares if my scrap is 21%? I'm still getting a payout. Sorry. So showing the KPIs without putting his name or their name on the board, how can you build those KPIs so that they understand how they're affecting it and you don't have the rest of the team carrying a load, whether it's a positive or a negative load?
Again, from this conversation, the transparency, right? Yeah. Throughout the organization. And I see that as missing in most organizations.
Yes.
The people down on the floor really don't understand how they are affecting the organization. They just do what they do each day and either get rewarded or not, but they're not really sure which one's going to happen.
Agree 100%, right? It's one thing to have a KPI on, say, a Gemba board or wherever you're going to go, your Obeya board, whatever it is. It's another thing to explain what it is to that frontline employee. And again, just on that, right? So many times when we hear and say frontline employees, we're automatically making the assumption that it's the one that's putting the poles in the ground or cutting the dies. But really, you have a frontline worker when it's that engineer, the last person that's going to design it. They're still the frontline worker. So I think that's another area where we make some assumptions on what a frontline worker is or who they are, and then exclude them when we're starting and trying to get that buy-in and that move forward on our continuous improvement journey.
Yes, that's an epiphany. Yes,
yeah. Definitely. I got my hand slapped a couple times because I kept saying, it's not just our crews that are frontline workers. You've got mechanics that are in the generating facility. You've got the engineers. You've got a scheduler, or you've got customer services frontline because they're working with the customers all day long. So there's a lot of different frontline.
In your sanitation crew. I mean, you'll clean it up.
Yeah.
It's the people down at the beginning that really, you know, it's that direct labor.
Well, and frontline is anyone that doesn't have anybody that reports to them, basically, is what it comes down to.
There you go. That the good definition. As a member of the Michigan Lean Consortium, what do you think is the biggest barrier that keeps companies stuck in executive lip service instead of building a true 7 steps foundation for sustainment?
So I think some of it is, again, depending on where you came from in an industry perspective and where you're going on that application. Not every manufacturing is one for one, as is manufacturing to service to any other, food or hospital or utility. So I think that's one of the challenges. You have the idea of implementing continuous improvement, and executives will do that great lip service, but not necessarily walk the talk. Some of that is, I think it's a leadership in general. Some of it is if you've had turnover in leadership. So just go back a little bit on that, and I'll finish up the question from a 7-step perspective. Is a previous CEO at the utility, not the fact that she was an industrial engineer, but industrial engineer, knew what continuous improvement was, knew what the benefits could be, and was going about, from my point of view, a good way of implementing and bringing everyone along in that journey. And then when that CEO left and went on, a new one came in, their perspective of what CI was and implementation changed it. And so you get that bumpy road, which causes some of that executive lip services because they're not sure what is the right thing. And if you're changing it yearly, which goes back to your 7 steps, which I absolutely love. Did they build out a plan? How we're going to implement this? What's the 2-year, 5-year, 10-year journey going to look like so that we can get the right culture, right? Did they explain that why? You know, step 2, buy-in from the company leadership, but all the way buy-in, all the way down. One thing that I'll say is a gap within reason is within the utility was there wasn't that deployment owner in a spot where the ownership had the authority to do what they needed to do for a proper ownership. I got step 4 here, right? Creating that understanding. If you're not, again, explaining that why, not building the KPIs and sharing them down, and not just an email that goes out or a Power BI board somewhere, but explaining what I do and how I contribute to it, that causes that disconnect, right? All the way through all of yours. So, and I love step 7, training the masses. Well, we have to train the masses, but all that training is going to vary depending on where you are in the company, what you do, and how you can apply it or how you would apply it.
Yes, that's excellent. I love that. The 7-step process, the biggest part of that is having the plan. And that's where most people fall. They jump right into, let's fix problems.
Here's 10 tools, go do them.
Yeah, they don't step back. It's like when you build a house. When you build a house, what's the first thing you have to have? And most people say a foundation. I say, well, that's not the first thing you need to have. You need to have money. You need to have buy-in, right? You need to have
the blueprints.
Yes. And then once you have the money and the plan and money and the buy-in, then you have to plan what the house is going to look like. You don't just go in and start swinging a hammer and hoping things show up.
Yeah. Right?
So they plan a house out well before they ever build the house. And then the rest comes. Most companies tend to not have the buy-in, not have the plan, and then build a window without the foundation. And the window doesn't have anything to stand on. So the window falls, window breaks, and it's the fault of the builder. No, it's not the fault of the builder. It's because we didn't plan it correctly. I always laugh when I see the House of Lean or the House of Six Sigma, and people see that all the time, but it falls on deaf ears because they just want the quick win. They want to build a window and go right into the house. It's not going to last unless you have these things.
That brings us to the end of an incredible discussion on why so many technical tool deployments lose momentum within 18 months. Thank you all so much for tuning in and giving us your time today. In this episode, we unpacked how picking too many corporate problems at once creates a visual and operational blindness that fractures psychological safety and stalls real transformation. We learned that sustainable change is never about handing an isolated professional a toolbox and hoping for a miracle. It requires an integrated culture, visual metric transparency, and a clear, unified structure where frontline employees truly understand how their daily efforts impact organizational success. If you want to dive deeper into protecting your organization from these exact operational traps, make sure to grab a free PDF copy of my book, Why They Fail and the Simple Key to Success, by clicking the link in the show notes below. Before you take off, please take a brief moment to subscribe to our YouTube channel. It is a completely free way to support what we do and helps us continue bringing you these deep dive operational insights. Make sure you are following the podcast on both Spotify and Apple Podcasts so you get every single new episode delivered instantly to your device. If you found today's conversation valuable, please leave us a 5-star review to help other continuous improvement professionals discover the show. Keep focusing on the data, build that stable foundation, and we will see you on the next episode.